Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics. We've got two segments up for tonight, as usual. First, in a little while, we'll talk about the case of Fahad Hashmi, who is a man of Pakistani descent, a longtime resident of the United States, grew up here in Flushing, Queens, and who is being held under the police state provisions that the Bush administration brought to American life after 9/11. We'll talk to his lawyer, his brother, and someone who is organizing publicity on his behalf. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined in the studio, I hope, because he hasn't shown up yet, but I'm sure he will be here, by the South African poet and political activist Dennis Brutus, who is in town to testify in a case of an attempt to get reparations for U.S. corporate complicity in the apartheid era, a case that is actually showing a strange longevity in the American court system. You think it would have died very quickly, but it's still around. It's been around for a few years, and we'll talk to Dennis about that. South African politics, Zimbabwe, and other related issues. And before we do all that, a few words about the economic news. I'll keep today's comments short to leave more time for the guests. The economic news remains pretty much the same as it's been for the last few weeks. The U.S. economy remains weak, with no signs of picking up steam and no signs of imploding either. And inflationary price pressures continue largely unabated. I have a feeling I may be saying some version of this for weeks, maybe months to come. The retail sales figures are showing a bit of a bounce, almost certainly because people are spending their rebate checks, despite all their professed good intentions of using them to pay down debts or add to savings. It does seem, though, that people are spending more on necessities than on splurges. And these days, gas is priced like a luxury. Speaking of gas prices, I'll have more to say about this in the near future, but let me just say this for now. I've been looking at some of the long-term stats on the supply of and demand for oil, and while the gap between supply and demand is tight, it's not crazy tight, meaning that it's hard to figure out why oil is trading at $135 to $140 a barrel, about 10 times what it was a decade ago. This suggests that speculation is contributing a lot to the price spike, even though Paul Krugman dismisses this analysis as a step away from conspiracism or something like that. There's an essential point about today's markets that make for a larger role for speculation in pushing prices up. In the old days, speculators in the futures market were both buyers and sellers. Sometimes one or the other predominated, but there was, over the long term, something of a balance. Over the last few years, though, we've seen an explosion in the growth of so-called index funds, in which pure financial operators, that is, players unlike refiners or airlines with no real interest in actual physical oil and its products, we've seen these players purchasing baskets of commodities, and the more prices go up, the more they purchase. So these are one-way bettors. They just buy, until, that is, prices might turn south for some reason, as they eventually will. Then it's quite possible they'll sell. In other words, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see the oil bubble burst sometime this year, just like the housing bubble and the pets.com bubble did in years past. We'll see. And a few words on presidential economic records. Full disclosure, I do not consider myself a Democrat. Although there are ways in which Democrats are mildly better than Republicans, they're still basically a party of business and empire. But there do seem to be some pretty significant differences in the way the economy performs under Democratic versus Republican presidents. I recently took a look at how some major indicators have performed over the years. A full story is a bit long and complex for a short radio commentary, but I'll boil it down to what's called a nut graph in the newspaper trade, a short paragraph that contains the heart of a story, and that is this. Under Democrats, the economy grows faster than under Republicans. So does employment. Under Democrats, the unemployment rate mostly falls. Under Republicans, it mostly rises. Also, on average, the unemployment rate is lower under Democrats than Republicans. And inequality tends to rise more under Republicans than under Democrats. The only area where Republicans excel are in getting inflation down and providing generous real returns for bondholders. And as a general rule, bondholders tend to do better when everyone else isn't. Of course, past performance is no guide to future results. But there is at least a dime's worth of difference between the parties on the economy. Maybe more than a dime, that's open to discussion. Though even under Democrats, workers are exploited to provide profits for shareholders and managers. Some things never change. All right, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the case of Fahad Hashmi. And we're back. That was a bit of the Au Pairs from 25 years ago. Their song Armagh, we don't torture, we're a civilized nation. That was about the Brits in Northern Ireland, but of course they did torture, even though they are supposedly a civilized nation. And of course we're not supposed to hold people in the style of secret police, because we're a civilized nation, but of course we do. And now we are going to talk about the case of Fahad Hashmi. So we are joined in the studio by three people. One, his lawyer, Sean Maher, his brother, Faisal Hashmi, and a Brooklyn College faculty member, Jean Thea Harris, is organizing publicity and protest on his behalf. Welcome to all three of you.
Good afternoon.
Sean, why don't you start by giving us some background on the case.
Fahad Hashmi is a 28-year-old American citizen. He was raised in Flushing, Queens, ever since he was 3 years old. He's a graduate of Brooklyn College, and in 2003, he enrolled in London Metropolitan University as a graduate student in international relations. He is charged now with providing material support to Al-Qaeda. He has four counts, and he's facing up to 70 years in federal prison. The crux of the government's allegations are not that Fahad's a member of Al-Qaeda, not that he gave anyone in Al-Qaeda any guns, money, ammunition, but that when he was a graduate student living in London in February of 2004, he allowed an acquaintance of his to stay in his apartment for about 2 weeks, and that acquaintance had in his own luggage some raincoats, ponchos, and waterproof socks. And the allegation is that that person then took that rain gear and gave it to the number three leader of Al-Qaeda in Pakistan fighting the Afghan insurgency. That is the allegation, that he allowed someone to knowingly keep raincoats, ponchos, and waterproof socks in his apartment.
That, to say the least, sounds completely preposterous. They're now holding him in solitary confinement?
He is in solitary confinement under what are called SAMs, Special Administrative Measures. These are extraordinary conditions of pretrial detainment that can only be imposed by the sponsorship of the Attorney General himself or herself. Fahad is not permitted to have any contact with the media. He basically can't have any contact with anyone in the outside world unless it's been approved by the government. He can meet with his attorneys. He's allowed the most bare-bone family visits. He can't write letters to people except for his immediate family under very constrained conditions. He has had no access to media, basically. He's on a 30-day delay, and they don't have to give him even a copy of the New York Times or the New York Post. That can be considered contraband under the SAMs.
But, of course, the government also has some secret evidence, right, that they're sharing with the judge but not you?
It's a very serious situation that we see growing in this country, this idea that we are going to carve out an exception in our adversarial system to use secret evidence. There's classified information in this case, and the government has convinced the judge to issue a protective order that this evidence, first of all, can't be shown to the attorneys until we have undergone a national security background check, the same level as a CIA officer. Once we get that approved, then we are allowed to see some of the classified information, but we're not allowed to share that with our client. So it raises questions. How can you defend someone if you can't show that person the evidence they're being accused with? How can you develop a defense theory as to what really happened if you can't test it with your own client?
How many people are being held under these SAMs?
It's hard to know the figures, but it's not many people. But it seems to be that the people that are under the SAMs tend to be Muslim.
I'm not surprised to hear that, but a stunning coincidence. The government hasn't exactly had a terrific success rate when they've brought people, so-called terrorists, to public trial, has they?
Well, there's a mixed record. There are some cases where there have been victories for people charged with these crimes, such as in the Holy Land Foundation in Texas. There's a case in Chicago where a man was acquitted. But there are a number of people who have been convicted on very flimsy evidence. People in Lodi, California, people in upstate New York, people in New York City. The problem is, once someone is branded as a terrorist with a federal indictment, the ability to get a fair and impartial jury is severely hampered. And the government, we argue, their standard proof basically goes to the floor. They don't have beyond a reasonable doubt at that point. You as a defense attorney have to show why your client absolutely is not guilty whatsoever.
When the Bush administration first started doing these sorts of things, it seemed at first that these were enemy combatants were going to be subject to this kind of extrajudicial treatment. Not American citizens. We're talking about American citizens here, right? So the notion that this is just reserved for foreigners is just baseless, isn't it?
Absolutely. And remember, Padilla is an American citizen who's also held in the brig for years without access to attorneys. So you see it from there in the Guantanamo context to we have people now in the federal system who are U.S. citizens being charged with crimes of terrorism, but who have serious due process concerns and how their cases are being handled.
What has the prosecution of Lynn Stewart done for the willingness of attorneys to take cases like this?
It has made a climate of fear become actualized. There are attorneys who won't take these cases, zealous, excellent defense attorneys who will not touch a case like this because they are afraid of having the government go through their background for the past 10 years, of having one misstatement in the press or to a colleague be taken as violating the stamps, as with Lynn Stewart. Right now, I am under an order that if I were to reveal some of the classified information I see, I can be prosecuted.
Did you get that security clearance?
I have been cleared. Uh-huh. But it's a tightrope because you have to then yourself compartmentalize this information. But you also have an ethical duty to zealously represent your client. That is a bare-bones ethical obligation of every attorney. But then you're thinking of yourself, client's needs versus am I going to get myself thrown in prison by what I say?
I assume you've been able to talk to your client. Can you discuss the case in any kind of reasonable fashion, or are you really constrained when you're talking to him?
Well, there obviously are severe constraints. There's a whole body of discovery that I'm barred from discussing with my client at this point. So, yes, there's a huge constraint. Then there's the aspect of are your conversations actually being recorded? Now, under the SAMs that we have in our case, they are not supposed to be recording, but we're in the booth that is equipped with electronic monitoring. Who knows what's being monitored? Lynn Stewart didn't think that she was being monitored. Lo and behold, she was.
And is there any kind of precedent for this in American law?
Which aspect of it?
Well, this kind of the constraints on free attorney-client relationships, the constraints on evidence.
I think we have seen waves in our history where government prosecutions have gone overboard. But to see how now we are actually changing the legal rubric, how we operate. We're not having an adversarial system anymore. What we're having is a circus in which the government holds all the cards. They decide who the attorney will be because they get to decide whether you pass a background check. They decide which evidence they're going to divulge. If they don't want to, the federal judge might make them comply, but most federal judges really step back and are reluctant to order the government to show what they really have.
You'd almost guess, though, that given this way they're stacking the deck, that they don't really have that strong a case, and they're having really to spin it in order to win victories. I know, obviously, you can't really comment on that, but it's just striking that if their case were so strong, they should be able to prevail in a normal judicial situation.
It makes you wonder.
That is the voice of Sean Maher, who is the lawyer for Fahad Hashmi, and we are here also in the studio here. We have Faisal Hashmi, his brother. How often do you get to see your brother?
I haven't seen him since they imposed the SAMs, so it's been 10 months. I saw him in court dates, that's about it.
But you couldn't be a closer relative, so what's the restriction on visitation?
Due bureaucracy with the SAMs. Sean can talk about it. I was approved, but I still wasn't allowed to see him.
Do you correspond with him at all?
Do I correspond with him? Not really. My parents are allowed to see him.
And what do they report on his well-being?
They cannot really report on his well-being. They cannot talk about do the SAMs.
They can't even say, like, you know, he's not well. He's not. They're just speechless?
Under the SAMs, you are not to discuss what you discuss with the person under the SAMs. And under an abundance of caution, the parents are not discussing what happens in that room because, again, of the fear of how these SAMs could be interpreted, although it's clear they should be able to say that. to be safe, that they themselves don't face federal prosecution, they're going the safe route and just not discussing what they see and hear.
Well, God, that's certainly understandable. What's on the docket? Is there a trial scheduled?
At this point, there was a trial scheduled for this summer, but it has now been pushed back because of a tremendous amount of classified information that the government has finally released to the defense in part. So that has now pushed any trial back.
And you've seen that, but you can't talk about it.
I'm beginning to review what that is, and I cannot discuss it.
But you can't discuss it. It's just surreal. I mean, this is. How does this compare to justice in the days of the Palmer raids, for example? Is this like similar, or is this unprecedented?
I don't know of cases in the Palmer raids where you had such a constrained view of discovery, where the attorneys themselves had to jump through so many hoops to be able to see the evidence, and then were, from the get-go, barred from showing it with their clients.
Gene Thien Harris, what are you doing to help the world know about this abomination?
Well, Fahad was a student of ours in political science at Brooklyn College, and he graduated in 2003. And so a number of us in the department had him, and when we learned about the case, and when he was extradited back to the United States from Britain, he was arrested in Britain on a U.S. warrant and was extradited.
Now, he was held in Britain with the normal prison population, too. He didn't get any of these kinds of this special treatment, right?
No, he was in Belmarsh Prison for almost a year in England, fighting extradition as any rational person would with these types of charges. No problems whatsoever, no allegation of any discussions with any terrorists, anything. No blemish on his record. But then he comes to the United States, and he's treated worse than notorious drug lords in the prisons.
Okay. Gene, you want to go on?
So when he was extradited back to the United States, if you recall the headlines, it was all about Brooklyn College terrorists caught, Brooklyn College terrorists extradited back, this kind of language about this young man, and a number of us who had him, and a number of us in on the faculty of Brooklyn College who had not had him were very dismayed by this kind of media and began to organize a statement of concern that we have sent this week, signed by 550 scholars and writers, including Eric Foner and Manning Marable at Columbia, Duncan Kennedy and Henry Louis Gates at Harvard, writers such as Susan Faludi and Casa Pollitt.
And me, I should say, I should disclose. So I'm not a disinterested party in this in this petition.
And so just this week we sent that statement of concern, which outlined three central concerns we have around the civil liberties issues that seem very paramount in this case, the first being the conditions of his detention, the second being his lack of access to ability to have a fair trial, and third, part of this case seems to rest on the fact that Fahad was very politically active, both as a student at Brooklyn College and then as a student in London. And so there are tremendous fears that this case is mostly going to be a trial of his political and religious beliefs.
Yeah, he is a devout Muslim and also was active in Muslim politics, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this, of course, is not a crime, but it is in this current environment. Considered almost a presumption of guilt, isn't it?
Right, right. And so I think one of our real fears with this is Fahad is very political, and that raises questions about a kind of new wave of kind of government persecution where they're going after political young people, we fear, and that this is about sending a message to other young people about speaking out. And so it has tremendous First Amendment potential, I think.
Yeah, now it's almost, God, it's, time passes, but it's almost going to be 7 years since 9/11. A lot of this has receded from the headlines, receded from consciousness, but it's still going on, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Are there other cases that are similar to this where people being held? How many? We have no idea.
Well, there's a recent white paper that was released by a law firm here in New York that documented around 130, 140 so-called terrorism cases brought within the federal courts. These aren't enemy combatant cases, but these are federal crimes of terrorism brought in federal courts over the year since 9/11. Interesting about this study, which was done by two former federal prosecutors in New York, was they concluded that there is absolutely no need to have any type of secret evidence court, any type of national security court that some people are starting to bandy about. Their conclusion, based on meticulous study of all these cases, is that good old federal courts with our longstanding traditions of adversarial advocacy is the best way to handle this type of situation.
Yeah, now if there are real evidence, you know, like I said before, it just seems like they could prevail in a real trial. But this is just pure secret police kinds of treatments. What happens to people when they're detained under these circumstances? That must be a real strain on their mental health, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think anyone who hasn't been in that situation can really understand what it's like to be locked up
23 hours a day in solitary.
23 at minimum in solitary, but that other hour in that day of so-called recreation is again in a solitary cage on that floor. You're not going outside. You're not going to walk through Central Park with a guard next to you. You're still by yourself locked up. Right now, Fahad under the SAMs is subject to electronic monitoring in his cell and outside the door of his cell. So if he even tries to talk to another prisoner, he's subject to even more sanction under the SAMs.
He can't talk to a neighboring prisoner.
Can't talk through the doors. That's also grounds for further sanctions.
Where is he being held now?
In MCC, the Federal Detention Center in Lower Manhattan.
All right, this is really very disturbing. What, if anything, can people listening do about this?
I mean, I think the first thing we want people to do, there is a petition at iPetition under Hashmi Rights. People can go to that. But what we want people to be doing is to be writing the Attorney General, calling the Attorney General. As Sean made clear, the SAMs were imposed under the kind of auspices of the Attorney General, and so that is the place we need to start. Because I think the first issue, you know, is the conditions under which he's being held, right? That I think have the potential to compromise his sanity and therefore even his ability to have a fair trial. So what we are asking people to do, again, is there is an iPetition, if people know, www.ipetition.com under Hashmi Rights. But we also are wanting people to call and ask the Attorney General to alleviate the conditions of his detention, to ensure a fair trial with full access to the evidence, and third, that his actions, not his beliefs or his associations, are the basis for that trial. Those are the three kind of organizing principles that we have been, that our statement of concern was focused around, but also the organizing on the ground is focused around. And so what we're asking people to do, again, is to call or write Attorney General Mukasey.
You wouldn't happen to have his phone number, would you? Sean, we've seen a rebellion among some military lawyers against the conditions of Guantanamo. What are your colleagues in the legal profession, if anything, doing in regard to this kind of outrage?
Well, there are a number of different organizations now that are finally getting involved. Some have been at the fight from the beginning, but there's a broad swath now of groups involved, from the ABA to the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers to the National Lawyers Guild. And what we see now is kind of somewhat of a coming together of these different parts of the bar. We see in the Guantanamo cases now that they're recruiting private attorneys to represent Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other people who are under death penalty charges, basically, in the kangaroo courts down in Guantanamo. And what just came out in the press now is that the Justice Department is barring those lawyers from getting paid to work on those cases until they get a license from the Treasury Department. So you see every time there's a move to try to bring real due process rights to people, you see a counter move by the Bush administration to stonewall and block that.
Faisal Hashmi, how's your family holding up under this?
We're doing all right. As you can imagine, it's a strain on my parents. There's, you know, my parents and two brothers. My father, you know, brought us here in the hopes of for education in 1982, and You know, he's worked for the city for over 25 years. He just retired. And we got our education. We have, you know, bachelor's degree. Fahad went on to pursue his master's degree. And, you know, we look to our faith for strength. And we have been able to, you know, persevere through that. But again, it's, you know, hard to imagine that, you know, your brother or your son is locked up in a room for 24 hours a day in some tower.
It's just really heartbreaking. Well, my sympathy and best wishes to you. And thanks to all three of you for coming by. I've been speaking with the last voice was Faisal Hashmi, the brother of Fahad Hashmi, who is being held in solitary confinement on what sound like ludicrous charges by our esteemed government. And also in the studio has been Jean Thier Harris of Brooklyn College and the lawyer Sean Maher, who is defending his client under extremely adverse circumstances. Thanks to all three of you. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk to Dennis Brutus. And that a bit, that was actually the entire Invention Number 14 by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Glenn Gould. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 on your FM dial. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News, and we're now joined in the studio by Dennis Brutus, the South African poet and political activist. And you can't introduce Dennis Brutus without pointing out that he did some time with Nelson Mandela on Robben Island. Welcome, Dennis. It's an honor to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So you're in town for a court case.
It's a complicated story, but I was supposed to be in court with Judge Spritzo on the reparations issue. Apparently, without notice, it's been rescheduled for September 23. So, as you may know, it was originally thrown out by him. We went on appeal. We got it okayed by three judges who sent it back to him. The corporations, who are the defendants, then took it to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court announced that it could not take the issue because four of the judges were shareholders of the corporations.
That says a lot about our Supreme Court, doesn't it?
I guess so. But we had hoped we would be on for yesterday, but apparently it'll now come up in September.
So you'll be back in September for this?
I hope. Oh, it's an expensive business.
Yeah, so give us some of the background on the case. It's about reparations for apartheid, right?
On the case itself?
Yes.
Well, as you know, thousands of people were victims of apartheid. Many, some were mutilated, some were tortured, some lost an eye, lost an arm. Many parents lost their teenage children, boys and girls. So you have a whole range of people who suffered injuries. And the South African government set up a piece of legislation called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And out of that commission, people were supposed to get reparations. Some did. Many did not. So we've then come under American law. We were able to come to the U.S. to sue the corporations under what's called, as you probably know, the Alien Torts Claims Act. Very ancient piece
of... It's like a 220-year-old law, isn't it?
A very ancient piece of American legislation. And initially, Judge Spritzo threw it out, on, among other reasons, because the South African Minister of Justice had asked for the case to be dismissed. So we lost at that level and then won on the appeal level.
Yeah, that I just want to emphasize that point. You're not getting any help from the South African government on this case, right?
On the contrary, not only has the Minister of Justice asked that it be thrown out, but when he stepped down, his successor, Bridget Mabandla, reaffirmed the request for dismissal in spite of the appeals court having agreed to hear it or send it back.
So what are the what corporations are involved and what exactly did they do?
They fall into three broad groups. There's banking, especially, and then, of course, there's the oil, Chevron, Exxon, Shell, of course, BP, so the British are involved, but also, in addition to, say, Chase Manhattan at that time, First National Bank. So you have a complex, but perhaps in my case, especially interesting. I lived in Port Elizabeth, which is where the headquarters of both Ford and GM were there. So you have all these corporations. The advantage they had was at that time South African law made it illegal for blacks either to join a trade union or to go on strike. So you could depress wages, pay starvation wages, but there's no redress for it.
And so you're suing to get some redress for that period, for general support of apartheid, exactly? What's the nature of the case?
We think that these victims are entitled to some compensation. It will never, of course, replace the loss of a son or daughter, but at least it would give them a chance for some kind of a decent living. Some of them are still in shacks, shanties, what are called informal settlements. There are now more of those post-apartheid than there were during apartheid.
Well, that is a good segue to the next part of the interview. I think the hopes that people had after the transition from apartheid were very, very high. Those hopes have been mostly dashed. Aside from the formal right to vote, how much change has there been in the distribution of wealth and power in South Africa?
Well, by their own accounts, in fact, the gap between rich and poor has widened, and you have more people now living below the bread line than before. But it is true, as you probably know, that under what's called BEE, what is Black Economic Empowerment, and we usually refer to it as Black Economic Elite Empowerment, you're getting a small segment of black society, millionaires, now doing very well. You might sit on the board of De Beers Diamond Mine, or you might be on the board of Consolidated Goldfield, or one of the big banking institutions, Barclays, or whatever. So for a few blacks, certainly there's been tremendous improvement, dramatic improvement. For the mass of the blacks, things are, in many cases, worse than they were under apartheid, and people are saying this.
Well, this is of not only importance to South Africa, but for politics and much of the rest of the world as well. The ANC was in so many ways such an admirable organization. It was a very principled, very serious, militant revolutionary organization. If they can't get it right on taking power, who can? So what happened?
I can't help being amused, but of course this is a serious matter. One fairly simple explanation is that while the people on the ground were confronting the ANC, confronting the government, you find the people who were in exile, the Thabo Mbekis and the Isipahats and the other, many of them studying at English universities. Thabo was at Sussex. Others were in Moscow, Patrice Lumumba. But they come back, and admittedly they have the skills that the people on the ground don't have because they were never allowed to hold positions of any responsibility. In addition, you find people from the ANC in exile beginning negotiations with Oppenheimer and the diamond mines and so on. Plus, sending young men of the ANC to serve as interns with the World Bank. So, in fact, when they come in, they're very well positioned to take over. And perhaps the clincher was the IMF saying to Nelson Mandela that the man who was the governor of the bank under apartheid, the National Reserve Bank, should continue. His name is Christoffs. So you have under Mandela the same man who was running the economy virtually under apartheid, holding the same position under Mandela. So it's not as if this was an accidental transition, and it's not as if they just stumbled into it. Clearly it was part of a pretty well-developed strategy.
Well, to use the old language, I guess they were a nationalist bourgeoisie of some sort who just wanted a piece of the action.
Well, yes, indeed, and we're very pleased at the outcome. Plus, as you may know, under the Truth and Reconciliation Act, many of those who had been murderers, members of hit squads, part of the torture teams, actually were able to get amnesty. All you had to do was to make some kind of confession. You did not have to express remorse. And in fact, the only condition was that if you did not fully give an account of your crimes, under those circumstances, you would not be given amnesty. But otherwise, everybody, many of them are walking around now smirking and saying, well, we got away with it.
That's the voice of Dennis Brutus, a South African poet and political activist who is here in the studio with us. What has this done to the morale of all the South Africans who struggled so mightily for freedom all those years? They must feel betrayed, weakened. How's this? What's the reaction? Are people demoralized? Are they still fighting? What's the attitude?
It's a tricky one. It seems to me that many people have a kind of nostalgic loyalty to the ANC. After all, this was the movement. This was the struggle. There were others, of course. There was the PAC, Pan-Africanist Movement. The ANC was added to it. That is fragment called, as you know, it broke away. You had the Unity Movement. You had various liberal kind of democratic civil rights groups as well. So when we formed the UDF, the United Democratic Front, it really was a very broad church. But many of those people now feel deeply frustrated, disappointed. But that sentimental loyalty is still there. Gradually, I think, the degree of disappointment is becoming so acute that particularly for the young people who are saying, what, is this what we struggled for? Is this what we were told the struggle was all about? So you now have a new generation. Very interesting, you find it among the poets in the ghettos and in the townships. The new kind of poetry is a poetry of anger, which says, Mbeki, where is the house you promised me? Where is the job you promised me? So it's very practical, very down to earth, rather than a kind of ideological or theoretical approach. It's grassroots anger. And it's gradually building up, but there's still, I think, among the leadership, say in the trade unions, COSATU and others, still sufficient of a loyalty attached to the old struggle. Even if the struggle has been kind of sold down the river, they're still clinging to it and the hope, you know, that there will be some kind of recovery.
And a lot of the struggles you're talking about on the ground are over very basic things like electricity and water, right? Isn't that the very important focus of political fighting now?
Some of it is certainly underground, but in fact, in the case of fairly basic things like water cutoffs, electricity cutoffs, a lack of sanitation, and no toilets, in those cases, it's very obvious, it's very visible, so it's not underground. But unfortunately, the police can come in, and they can deal with people, use rubber bullets. So in a curious way, the pattern of the struggle under apartheid is being repeated, except that now we're up against black cops and no longer the white cops of the apartheid regime.
And there is a succession battle in the ANC, right? We have Jacob Zuma, the newish leader, and Mbeki, his days are numbered, right? He's leaving office.
Pretty much a lame duck, everybody accepts that. But more seriously, I think, and I don't know whether you want to get into this, but unfortunately, the Zuma faction and the Mbeki faction, the differences are about power. They are not about policy.
Now, from a distance, Zuma is seen as the more militant, you know, more in line with the ANC's old traditions against the kind of yuppie politics of Mbeki, but that's not really true, huh?
I think that's only partly true. But, you know, when Zuma goes to Davos, to the World Economic Forum, he says to the corporate heads that you've got nothing to worry about because the economic policy under Mbeki will be the same when I become president, both president of the ANC and president of the state.
And let's talk a bit about your neighboring country, Zimbabwe. There are quite a few folks who are seduced by Mugabe's anti-imperialist rhetoric around the world and think that all the nasty stories you hear about Mugabe's regime are just inventions of British and American imperialism. What's your position on that?
Well, I try to be honest and fair, and I have to remind you, and I remind people in South Africa, that when Mugabe came to power as a result of the negotiations at the Marlborough House and so on, he had what were called the sunset clauses, so he was limited in what he could do. And so I'm not sure he's always justly condemned on those grounds, but certainly since then, he's made an awful mess, whether it's the economy, land seizure, land distribution. So, of course, as you probably know, Mbeki has consistently supported him. So there's no real challenge coming from South Africa. And without that challenge, Mbeki doesn't feel he has to change.
But it seems like it's presented as if there's only two choices, which is one to support Mugabe and the other to support Anglo-American intervention. Is there a third option?
I think so, but it's not. It is not between, say, Mugabe and MDC. It seems to me that much of the policy is pretty much the same. There is a younger, more critical generation, much more left-leaning. I think that's where the third option is.
Where are they centered?
Numerically, they're still not very strong. And they get beaten up, of course, but for Mugabe, his main target is the supporters of Tsvangirai rather than supporters of younger people. The MDC is his target.
Again, that's the voice of the South African poet and activist Dennis Brutus, who is with us in the studio. There have also been some horrifying sites of xenophobic attacks in South Africa. Tell us, what's been going on? What's that all about?
They are there, and they are real, but I'm not sure they're being correctly diagnosed. A lot of that anger is black South Africans, frustrated because of their unfulfilled promises, the expectations that were not realized. And if, in fact, there are people coming in who are even moderately affluent, moderately comfortable, they then become the targets of anger of South Africans. But the troubling thing for me is that the government is determined not to admit that some of this anger is because of their failure to deliver these services. And they keep saying, oh, well, you know, it's just hostility based on ethnicity or culture. I think it's sort of a real anger, and it's just unfortunate that the targets are the wrong targets.
And you're, aside from being a political analyst and activist, a poet, and I asked you to bring a poem or two along to read, so why don't you let us have one?
I guess one is a kind of reaction to something I saw as I was coming out of South Africa. An enormous military arms plant right on the airport in Johannesburg. This is the old Denel, which was part of the arms production under apartheid. They're still functioning pretty well under the post-apartheid government. So I was very angry about that, and particularly they were involved in the production of cluster bombs. And so I wrote a poem which is really about that. I don't know. It's fairly short, so perhaps we should just take a quick look at it. Shiny, bright baubles, silvery blue, like ornaments on a Christmas tree. Lovely toys, lovely playthings, till they explode till they detonate. These cluster bomblets in the hands of children, little girls, little boys, explode, detonate, and kill, mutilate, mutilate, mutilate.
Thank you. That poem by Dennis Brutus, and it's hard for me to say anything after that. For whom are these bombs being made?
Irony. South Africa sells to both sides in a conflict because they're not interested in the causes. They're interested in the marketing. And in fact, one of the ministers, Carter Housemaul, said, we discovered that under the apartheid government, an important source of revenue was the sale of arms. And so we've decided to continue with the sale of arms.
Well, in those days, South Africa was selling it to the rogue states of the world. It was selling to the bad guys, and it was working with Israel to sell it to the bad guys. Is it still working the same markets? Is it still selling the same kinds of people?
Hard to say. I'm not sure I can generalize. Certainly, there's still very friendly relations with Israel on the one hand. And, of course, South Africa, under apartheid, was attacking its neighbors because it saw the resistance people were finding shelter, whether it was in Zimbabwe or Zambia or Namibia or elsewhere. So you have a pretty big arms industry still, although if you read what they're saying, I'm afraid they're interested in even expanding that. As you may know, there's a huge scandal going on about the deals with German arms industry and loans from Deutsche Bank and so on. So that I'm not sure if I'm quite answering your question, but in my own mind, I have no doubt that the South African arms industry is still a pretty large portion of the economy.
You've been a poet for many, many years. Were you always a political poet, or were you an aesthetic poet, or have you always blended the two? How did you get into politics?
Well, it seems to me that if you grew up in a society where you were surrounded every day by various manifestations of racism and oppression, you couldn't keep it out of your poetry, even if you wanted to. So it seems to me it got in anyway. And, of course, I was arrested and jailed and sent to Robben Island, shot by the secret police. So I had a whole range of experiences, personal as well as the general one.
And you, I guess your first real high-profile political action was about the Olympics in South Africa, right? You tried to keep the Olympics out of South Africa?
Yes, tell us
that story.
And, as you may know, succeeded. And that's quite a difference because there are lots of campaigns where you don't win. You struggle and you do pretty well, but you don't win. But in the case of sport, both in the case of South Africa and of Rhodesia as it was then, I was able to get them expelled because they could not both be racist and be part of the Olympics. The Olympic Charter says you have to give everybody a chance. It's selection on merit. So when they said only whites can be on the team, that was enough to get them expelled.
And you recently refused induction to the Sports Hall of Fame in South Africa. Why did you do that?
Well, I pleased that you know of it. It's a very curious kind of hodgepodge of pro-apartheid heroes being combined in the same Hall of Fame with those who had opposed apartheid. And I said I couldn't be comfortable being in the Hall of Fame with people who had actively organized international tours, even after the UN had called for an embargo of South Africa. So it was, for me, inconsistent, and so I rejected the honor, if that's what it was.
I see, do you have another poem here for us? You have another poem for us here?
Well, this is going to be a little cheeky. Something I wrote yesterday, I think. I wrote a very nice poem, I think, for Nelson Mandela when he came out of prison. In fact, Roger Wilkins had written a brilliant essay about him in the New York Times, on the op-ed page. You had a piece by Roger Wilkins on him coming out of prison, and I responded to it with a poem. But I'm responding to something new which you may not be aware of. Nelson Mandela has set up an enormous foundation which is called the Mandela Cecil Rhodes Foundation. And this seems to me such a contradiction between the man who was a robber, a land baron and everything else, and a thug as well. So I wrote a poem about that, and I'd like to read it, although of course it'll get me into trouble. Yes, of course, one must pity one's heroes when they cheapen their fame. They lower themselves in our esteem and cash in on a name or a fame or whatever. Just for a handful of silver he left us, just for a ribbon to wear on his coat. That was Browning, lamenting at Wordsworth's betrayal. They say he regretted it afterwards. But so there are the ups and the downs of time. A school teacher, he dismissed me after I'd sheltered him, his name having then become a commonplace. It is not difficult, once you are famous, to lie down with dogs, with curs, with cads, and pillagers, and robber barons, and marauders, and freebooters, and Cecil John Rhodes.
And that's the voice of Dennis Brutus reading one of his poems, hot off the press, huh, from yesterday. And I'm shocked to hear the names Mandela and Rhodes paired like that. It's just really, it destroys one's faith in humanity, really.
I'm afraid so.
Well, thank you for joining us very much, Dennis Brutus. It's been very honored to have you here. And if you come back here to testify in September, I hope you pay a return visit to these studios. I've been speaking with Dennis Brutus, the South African poet and political activist. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on at the evening. And let's go out with this from 1979, Laura Logic, Essential Logic. Her real name, Susan Whitby, I believe. I learned this afternoon. And what is this called? This is called Wake Up, which is always a good idea. Till next week. Bye. Okay, but let it go.